Now, one of the reasons why we're asking if perhaps elements of our national security establishment or right-wing extremists such as G. Gordon Liddy and others might be involved in, you know, we're not saying that Liddy's, well, of course, Liddy was part of the Dirty Tricks Watergate gang, but one of the reasons why we're asking that question and speculating about the large number of obituaries of liberals dying in their early 40s, late 30s and, of cancer is that one of the things that emerged in the Watergate hearings was that indeed the dirty tricksters, the elements of the Plumbers Unit, Donald Segretti's political dirty tricks group, were involved in spreading chemicals around at meetings of various Democratic Party organizations. Reading now from the, well, it's part of the transcripts of the hearings before the Select Committee on Presidential Activities, starting once again, hearings before the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities of the United States Senate, 93rd Congress, First Session, Watergate and related activities, and this is phase two campaign practices. And the transcripts here are from the hearings in Washington, D.C. of October 4th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 31st of 1973. This is book two, printed for the use of the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities, U.S. Government Printing Office, Washington, 1973. Research credit for the following information goes to Mae Russell, a long-standing affiliate of ours here who's, well, basically, sort of, we're an affiliate of hers, one of the top researchers in this field, and a woman who's done a lot of very, very pivotal research. And again, on page 4412 of this particular volume of the transcripts, we find the following discussion. This concerns the interrogation of Robert M. Benz, a member of Donald Segretti's Dirty Tricks organization. Segretti was part of the White House Dirty Tricks team during Watergate, and this is during the interrogation of Robert M. Benz, last name B-E-N-Z, by the Senate Select Committee. And in the discussion here with a Mr. Lenzner, Mr. Lenzner asks Benz, and again reading on from page 4412, what discussion did you have with him at that time? Mr. Benz, I cannot recall the conversation, but I do recall him instructing me to place this liquid substance into the headquarters of Senator Muskie, the two headquarters in Tampa, and also at the picnic. I do not recall if that was at that particular time or not. Mr. Lenzner, was this shortly before the primary of March 14th? Mr. Benz, that is correct. Mr. Lenzner, what did you do with those? Mr. Benz, I gave them to Mr. Hearing, H-E-A-R-I-N-G. Interjecting, Mr. Hearing is one of Mr. Benz's subordinates in the Dirty Tricks unit. Mr. Lenzner, and to your knowledge, what did Mr. Hearing do with the chemical compound? Mr. Benz, as he told me, he placed those into the headquarters of Senator Muskie. Mr. Lenzner, into two headquarters? Mr. Benz, correct. Mr. Lenzner, they were two different locations? Mr. Benz, that is correct. Mr. Lenzner, was one of the headquarters called the telephone bank? Mr. Benz, that is correct. Mr. Lenzner, were these placed the day before the primary? Mr. Benz, evening. Mr. Lenzner, the evening of the primary? Did Mr. Hearing indicate how they gained entrance to those buildings? Mr. Benz, they did not gain entrance. Mr. Lenzner, well, how did they get access to them? Mr. Benz, access to the building? Mr. Lenzner, so they could throw or do whatever they had to with the chemical. Mr. Benz, well, in one building there was a hole in the window which they dropped the substance through. In another building, as it was told by me, the screen was open and the window was open and they dropped it in. Mr. Lenzner, they didn't tell you that they removed the screen? Mr. Benz, that is correct as I recall. Mr. Lenzner, which is correct, that they did remove the screen or they didn't? Mr. Benz, as I recall, the screen was already open. Mr. Lenzner, what did Mr. Hearing do with the other chemical? Mr. Benz, they took that to the picnic. It was a Senator Muskie picnic, and they emptied the vial at the picnic. Mr. Lenzner, where was that picnic held? Mr. Benz, it was on the grounds of the Mary Help of Christians Church School. Mr. Lenzner, you and Mr. Segretti observed that picnic, did you not? Mr. Benz, no, we did not. Mr. Lenzner, you were not in the area? Mr. Benz, not at the time of the picnic. Mr. Lenzner, did you pay Mr. Hearing for those? Mr. Benz, yes, I did. And over on page 4413 to 4414, we find the following exchange on the same subject. Mr. Lenzner, going back to the picnic where the chemical was distributed, do you recall telling the FBI agents who interviewed you in May of this year that you drove down to the Muskie picnic on Sunday evening and noticed that the chemical had been distributed? Mr. Benz, that is correct. Mr. Lenzner, so you did go to the picnic area. Mr. Benz, I did go to the picnic area. I did not attend the picnic, as you said before. What chemical did the Watergate, now obviously that's the end of this particular section of transcript, the Watergate Committee did not pursue what chemicals those were, what sorts of effects they may have had on the people in the convention. So the question we're asking, might it have been some of those cancer chemicals, or could other similar procedures be being followed at political and social gatherings today?
One of the other interesting things is, as mentioned, well, actually, one of the things that happened to Muskie is Muskie was famous for having a weeping breakdown in the middle of that particular campaign. Another interesting thing is during that same campaign in 1972, George Wallace, I'm sorry, I'm losing my grip on names here. George Wallace was shot down by a man by the name of Arthur Bremer, who managed to travel around for several months and spend thousands and thousands of dollars in outlay with no income whatsoever, according to his entire family and all of his friends. He had no source of money whatsoever, spent thousands of dollars to follow presidential candidates around, eventually bumped off George Wallace, who might have been possibly a threat to pull away some of Richard Nixon's conservative southern voters and things of that nature, and eventually, no doubt, George Wallace's failure to complete the race was an aid in Nixon's eventual victory over McGovern. So there were a lot of interesting things going on that election besides the dropping of chemicals into the Muskie Party's picnic and stuff like that, but certainly that in and of itself is rather significant in view of, again, the, quote, kooky talk that Dave and I have been engaging in as regards the willingness of certain people in the security establishment to do things to people who they don't agree with.
And again, labeling the role of Nazis and former SS men and so forth as kook talk seems a little strange, and lightly, as we indicated in Inside the League, that Reed Irvin himself was involved in helping to counteract the bad publicity generated by these elements within the World Anti-Communist League. By the way, I think I incorrectly read this. This is from Book 11 of the Watergate and Related Activities, the hearings before the Select Committee on Presidential Campaign Activities. It's from Book 11, and again, from the hearings of October 4th, 9th, 10th, 11th, and 31st of 1973. Skipping over to page 4426 of this same book of transcripts, and it's still the questioning of Robert M. Benz by the Senate Select Committee. Senator Talmadge, I believe you had two subordinates. One was named Mr. Duke, and the other one was named Mr. Hearing. Is that right? Mr. Benz, his nickname was Duke. I do not believe that was his real last name. Senator Talmadge, one was named Duke and the other Hearing? Mr. Benz, correct. Senator Talmadge, did Mr. Hearing tell you that this man Duke was a former SS officer for Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers? Mr. Benz, correct. Senator Talmadge, did you believe that? Mr. Benz, no, sir. Senator Talmadge, did Duke ever tell you that? Mr. Benz, I do not recall if he ever did or not. Senator Talmadge, did you feel that being trained by Adolf Hitler and his stormtroopers particularly qualified him for the duties that you assigned him to? Mr. Benz, I do not know of any training school that would train him for this work. Senator Talmadge, I could not hear you. Mr. Benz, I said I do not know of any training school that would train a person for this type of work. Senator Talmadge, were not the activities quite similar? Did not Hitler's Nazi stormtroopers perform similar activities to what you were engaged in Florida? Mr. Benz, I would not know that, Senator. Senator Talmadge, you have read some history of that period, have you not? Mr. Benz, correct. Senator Talmadge, you have read Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, I take it? Mr. Benz, correct. Senator Talmadge, are not the activities of the Nazi stormtroopers somewhat similar? Mr. Benz, I do not recall if he ever did or not. Interesting, not the most grammatical reply, but anyway. Senator Talmadge, I thought they were. I read about a good many falsified documents during the era and libels and slander about the opposition. It was one of the ways, as I recall, that Adolf Hitler achieved power. Do you think Duke carried on his activities in an exemplary fashion in that manner, do you? Mr. Benz, yes, sir. Senator Talmadge, no further questions, Mr. Chairman. So again, that perhaps the notion of Nazis and SS men dispatching political opponents through cancer, what were the chemicals that they were spraying around, and how many other political gatherings over the years have had chemicals sprayed in them? Again, we don't know, and they did not pursue that, but this is why we are asking the question. We're not stating, yes, they are doing it. We're stating, it looks suspicious. Are they doing it?
Yeah, Mr. Duke's background is also rather interesting. And last but not least, in terms of that last little snippet there, again, note the reference to slandering and libeling and cooking up cases, drumming up cases against the opposition that have very little to do with the facts and have everything to do with suppressing information that makes people nervous. One last article we're going to read before we take a break, and this is following up on the whole thing. And again, another little, Dave mentioned earlier, the cosmetic work of our new friend. And we're going to read another short section here from Inside the League. And it's clear from the article, from the context. in reaction to the Jack Anderson articles that exposed CAL. CAL, by the way, is the Latin American Anti-Communist Confederation, which is an affiliate of World Anti-Communist League. In reaction to the Jack Anderson articles that exposed CAL in January 1984, Singlob turned to a prominent friend in the New Right for help. His January 30th, 1984 letter to Reed Irvine of Accuracy in Media concludes, quote, "Any help that you can give us in obtaining a retraction from Jack Anderson for that part of his articles which link Wackle with the Death Squad activity will be greatly appreciated. If a retraction is not possible, I would appreciate your assistance in neutralizing the negative impact of these articles," unquote. No retraction was made, for nothing had really changed in the League. Those that were purged in 1984, not in 1983, as Singlob asserts, were the Mexican Tecos. The others, the Bolivians who first announced the Banzer Plan, the Guatemalans who established that nation's death squads, and the Brazilians who coordinate the political warfare training program for Taiwan, are still there and still wielding their deadly influence. So, again, Mr. Irvine should be familiar with these kinds of things. Again, with combating the truth, with slurs and heavy-handed tactics. And, again, it'll be interesting to see, especially after Warren Hinkle's article this week, if Accuracy in Academia, or more likely in this case Accuracy in Media, decides to go after the San Francisco Chronicle-Examiner instead of, as Dave said, trying to stomp on a relatively weak sister like KFJC in terms of clout. Now, when it comes to heart, you know, that's we got one as big as All Outdoors at this station. So, anyway, one last thing again before we go back. And, again, Mr. Irvine, if you're out there, you get this. We welcome the opportunity to have you come by and or send one of your representatives if you'd like and respond to some of these things in person, maybe offer some of the facts that you feel contradict the things that we have to say. Instead of resorting to ad hominem attacks and letters from Washington, send somebody out in person. We'd love to put them on the air.
As I say, if you can countermand the information from credible sources, we'd be more than happy to put it on and correct the record.
Absolutely. Anyway, and with that, we're going to take a short break. We've got more stuff to talk about, so don't go away. We've got lots more things. It's going to be a real interesting show, and then later on we're going to have your phone calls, which are always interesting. Okay? Okay, so Dave and I are going to take a break. You all get up and run around for a few minutes. We'll be back with more One Step Beyond when we return in just a moment. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills. One Step Beyond Sanity. Here we are, Kooks on the Loose. This is NipTech with Dave Emery. If you just tuned in, what we're responding to is the article we read at the beginning of the show from Accuracy in Academia, the sister crusade to Accuracy in Media, which has been sort of the focus of our broadcast tonight because they chose to take one of our broadcasts into November 9th in specific and pull out some sections of it and hold them up and basically not argue with any of them at all except to say, did you know these kinds of kooks are on the radio? So we're talking about not only the broadcast itself and some of the points that we made in that broadcast that they're labeling as nuts, but of course we're talking a little bit about Reed Irvine, the man behind Accuracy in Media and Accuracy in Academia, and some of his rather interesting contacts with the World Anti-Communist League, a rather entertaining group, a group with an entertaining, not necessarily in the ha-ha funny sense, but in the ha-ha strange sense, a group made up as the authors of Inside the League quote a former League member as saying, group made up with a collection of Oriental fascist militarists, right-wing terrorists who put bombs in civilian aircraft, death squads, assassins, criminals, and many people who are as much opposed to democracy as they are to communism. This is the milieu, according to a former World Anti-Communist League member. Reed Irvine himself has been connected for a long time with the World Anti-Communist League, as it must be stated quite firmly, as is a large amount of the Reagan administration and those ideologically tied to the Reagan administration. So although we're focusing on Mr. Irvine and his group tonight just because they have chosen to make us the object of one of their articles, in fact, this goes all the way down the line, and a lot of people who've been involved with Ronald Reagan and his type of policy for a long time also have been involved with the World Anti-Communist League. And, of course, Lev Dobryansky, the ambassador to the Bahamas, was one of them mentioned in the book itself. So, and Pat Buchanan has a lot of friends in the World Anti-Communist League who he's come to the defense of in the past, and all kinds of interesting folks. So it's not just Mr. Irvine. We hasten to say, if it was, we wouldn't bother to respond. We just let it slide off our back like water off of a duck.
Yeah, hand me the accuracy and academia report there for a second. I just wanted to kick off the next part of the discussion here by making a reference. One of the interesting things, and again, we're going to have to get the November 9th program from DAVCOR, where it is residing at the moment, and check this for itself. But one of the things that has piqued our interest here with regard to the possible focusing of accuracy and media-accuracy and academia on our situation concerns why they would be going after us at this particular point in time. And one of the things to think about is that this area is one of the areas which is figured very one of the hot spots of attention in the Iran scam Contragate scandal currently unfolding. One of the things that we read on the air here was some information from the San Jose Metro, which dealt with Albert Hakim, the former associate of Edwin Wilson and Frank Turples, whose name has cropped up in a prominent way with regard to the Iran scam hyphen Contragate. And specifically, we talked about Stanford Technology, his company International Imaging Systems, which was part of Otto von Bolschwing's TCI, and then part of the Stanford Technology Group, for which the Turple and Wilson worked when they were doing their Libyan operation. And again, we haven't got time to fill in all the details on this from past discussions, but past archive shows dealing with Turple and Wilson, Radio Free America number 4, will fill in some of this information. Now, this area, and we'd spoken about the connections between Helena von Damm and Otto von Bolschwing, and one source was quoted in the Metro as stating that Helena von Damm worked for some of Hakim's subsidiaries abroad. Remains to be seen just how firmly that shapes up, but it's interesting information, as we like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research. One of the things that had occurred to us is that not only the fact that we do focus on the intelligence community, on the sorts of activities that have come to light in connection with Iran scam Contragate, we thought that that might be one of the reasons why we are being focused on so heavily by, or targeted, or whatever word you would want to use, by accuracy in media and accuracy in academia. It's worth noting that the World Anti-Communist League has cropped up in connection with Iran scam Contragate in a big, big way, and we're going to talk about one of the possible connections which may have drawn the attention of the authorities here. As we said, the fact that we're doing this here in the Silicon Valley, with all of the information that has now emerged concerning Albert Hakim, or the allegations that have emerged concerning Albert Hakim and his connection to this whole case, is worth considering. Also, the fact that in the Accuracy in Academia report, there's an interesting phrase here, and we'll go into this when we get to the program back from DAVCOR, we'll have to see. But I'm quoted here as saying, one of the key stockholders was Katherine Graham, whose affiliation with CIA, as well as the Washington Post and Newsweek, we discussed in a Radio 88.1 One Step Beyond show that is available from DAVCOR. Well, the relevant information concerning Gloria Steinem's CIA background, her relationships with people like Katherine Graham, Elizabeth Forsling Harris, and, last but certainly not least, J. Stanley Pottinger, is at DAVCOR. However, I wonder whether I would have said a Radio 88.1 One Step Beyond show. I mean, generally, I don't refer to our frequency here when I refer to One Step Beyond, and our frequency here is 89.7. Now, one of the things that caught our interest about this was the fact that our work is featured on a number of different stations, and one of the largest that carries our work regularly, and I guess they have been broadcasting the Radio Free America tapes in one-hour excerpts, is an FM station in Toronto, Canada, called CKLN, whose frequency is 88.1. And we just wondered, at the odd coincidence, I will not state categorically that I was not perhaps suffering from brain bubbles at that precise moment or whatever, but I just don't think I would have identified, One Step Beyond as 89.7 even, or certainly not Radio 88.1.
I've never heard you do it.
I'm extremely doubtful,
but yeah, we'll give it the once over.
But there is a station, an FM station in Toronto, which not only covers the entire city of Toronto, but from most of the province of Ontario, and I guess also has some listenership in upstate New York and Michigan, that has been broadcasting Radio Free America tapes in one-hour excerpts. And interestingly enough, a Toronto connection, and specifically a connection of a Toronto Wackle connection, has emerged in the background of Iran scam Contragate. Reading now from the Village Voice of December 30th, 1986, is a regularly featured column called The Moving Target by James Ridgway. And this one's entitled Channel to Wackel, referring to Carl Russell Channel, a Wackel fundraiser and a fellow affiliated with Western Gold and some other organizations.
Known to many as Spitz Channel, if that helps to jog any memories out there.
And the article, again, The Moving Target by James Ridgway from the Village Voice of December 30th, 1986, deals with possible Wackel connections to Iran scam Contragate and a very important Toronto connection. Dateline, Washington, D.C. Retired General John L. Singlaub may well have played a far more direct role in the... I think it was supposed to be John K. Singlaub. Retired General John K. Singlaub may well have played a far more direct role in the Iranian arms deal than previously known. As head of the World Anti-Communist League in 1985, Singlaub had at his fingertips an international political network to channel funds to the Contras. Last week, CTV in Toronto reported that John Gamble, G-A-M-B-L-E, the top North American Wackel official, was a principal in the Canadian company that helped to finance the arms sale. Singlaub is vice chairman of NARWACL, and it was North American division of Wackel. This story begins with Adnan Khashoggi, the Saudi Arabian arms dealer who helped arrange U.S. arms sales to Iran. CIA Director William Casey testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee 2 weeks ago that Roy Furmark, F-U-R-M-A-R-K, a New York businessman with ties to Khashoggi, had warned him that a group of Canadian investors had threatened to break open the arms deal because they had not recovered their money. It was then revealed that two Toronto businessmen, Donald Fraser and Ernest Miller of Vertex Investments Limited, a Canadian firm, had provided $21 million in credit to Khashoggi through the company's Cayman Islands affiliate. Last week, CTV reported that there was a third Canadian member of the Vertex group, John Gamble, a Toronto lawyer and former member of parliament. Gamble is the treasurer and a director of Vertex. He also heads NARWACL. Again, that's the North American division of Wackel. Both Vertex and Wackel's Canadian branch are located in Gamble's law offices in the suburbs of Toronto. So, interesting to speculate about the possible Toronto connection to Wackel and its emergence in Iran Gate Contra scam. And one of the interesting things, too, the Steinem material, that they focused on the Steinem material, is intriguing to consider in the same light. At this point, perhaps the most intriguing of Gloria Steinem's connections concerns that of her long relationship with J. Stanley Pottinger. Apparently it dissolved a few years ago, but she was, according to Newsweek magazine, the paramour of J. Stanley Pottinger, or vice versa, for some 9 years. Now, Pottinger was a former assistant attorney general for civil rights in the Nixon and Ford administrations. Beyond that, in a book called Death in Washington by Donald Freed and Fred Landis, which we quoted in the archive tape called Gloria in Excelsis, which is available from DAVCOR, we looked at a couple of interesting connections of J. Stanley Pottinger. First of all, according to Fried and Landis in that book, Pottinger was instrumental in deflecting the investigation into the assassination of Martin Luther King away from the Justice Department when it became, when the trail began leading in the direction of the FBI. Beyond that, he also was involved in the prosecution of the assassination of Orlando Letelier, which the authors, that is to say Fried and Landis, the authors of Death in Washington, make a very good case that in fact the prosecution was incomplete, that many powerful elements, including elements of U.S. intelligence, were involved with Letelier's assassination, and in fact that those connections were left out of the prosecution, that prosecution coordinated in part by J. Stanley Pottinger. But perhaps the most important or interesting connection of J. Stanley Pottinger was that in 1984, in an article quoted in that archive show, Gloria in Excelsis, the New York Times raised Pottinger's name in connection with a deal to sell arms to Iran, and the key name in connection with the alleged Pottinger deal was none other than Cyrus Hashemi, the late Cyrus Hashemi, who died, according to official reports, of leukemia, although his brother stated that certain Middle East intelligence services have the means of giving people a disease, which have a means of assassination which simulates leukemia, which is intriguing in light of our speculations concerning cancer. But anyway, Cyrus Hashemi was one of the key figures involved in the Iran scam Contragate. Apparently, he was involved both with an arms sting to prevent arms from going to Iran, and also was involved in the Iranian arms sale itself. So, J. Stanley Pottinger's name surfacing in connection with Cyrus Hashemi is intriguing in and of itself, and perhaps, and we're just speculating here, but perhaps that has something to do with the fact that the Steinem material surfaced in accuracy in academia's, in their indictment of our work here.
As a matter of fact, since this brought this to mind, we're talking about the Orlando Letelier assassination. Now, one of the things that we have not had time to talk about tonight, and will not, at least as far as articles, is the appearance of Fernandez Loria, a former member of the the Chilean intelligence and military police hierarchy, who has showed up in the United States apparently to make some kind of deal with U.S. prosecutors to talk about the Letelier assassination, and has implicated, among others, General Augusto Pinochet. Interesting, certainly seems like a big fish. However, as those of you who have read Death in Washington know, Pinochet may not be the biggest fish, which sounds strange to say since he is president of Chile, but he may not be the biggest fish in the Letelier assassination. One of the reasons I bring this up is to suggest that those of you who do not have a copy of Death in Washington, that you go track one down, again, by Donald Fried and Fred Landis. Those of you who do have a copy and you haven't read it for a few years, I suggest you might want to crack it out and break it open. That's what I was trying to say. Because we're going to be talking about it, I'm fairly sure that we're going to be seeing some things come up in light of this case that we're going to find interesting and are going to make their way onto the air. So those of you out there might want to do yourself a favor if you haven't read it. It's an excellent book, and I'm sure it will come up in weeks to come. Now, while we're talking about the media blitz, the right-wing media blitz here, and the way that certain types of things are being done, as we ourselves seem to be victims of, at least in part, although so far it's fairly low-key, and we hope it stays that way. This is an article from the San Jose Mercury News for Friday, February 6, 1987. The article is headlined, Southern Air Files Suit Against Newsweek, and it's a Washington AP, it's an AP Wire story, Dateline Washington. Southern Air Transport, Inc., linked to arms shipments to Iran and Nicaraguan rebels, Thursday filed a libel suit against Newsweek over an article about alleged cocaine smuggling by the Contras. The Miami-based air carrier, which was once owned by the CIA, sought $20 million in punitive damages for the article that appeared in the magazine's January 26th issue. The company charges that it was defamed by pictures of an accused drug smuggler, George Morales, superimposed on a photograph of a Southern Air plane, and by an accompanying caption. Caption beneath the photograph said, quote, suspects, Southern Air and accused smuggler Morales. The lawsuit charges that the, quote, photographs and caption were intentionally and maliciously crafted to catch the reader's attention and convey to the reader the false and defamatory impression that Southern Air was, like Morales, suspected of smuggling drugs, unquote. David M. Kirstein, the plaintiff's attorney, acknowledged there were other published reports saying witnesses saw cocaine being loaded on a Southern Air plane in Colombia. But Southern Air decided to sue Newsweek, he said, because, quote, our feeling was this article was beyond the pale of professional journalism, unquote. Quote, the way it's put together was to create an impression that has no basis in fact, unquote, Kirstein said. Newsweek spokesman Gary Girard said magazine editors in New York City had not seen the lawsuit and could not comment. The article was published before Morales pleaded guilty in Miami to drug smuggling charges. It included statements also made in other publications by Morales and convicted smuggler Gary Betzner that the Contras smuggled drugs to the United States with a knowledge of the CIA, the FBI, and the Drug Enforcement Administration. So, Southern Air Transport has decided that the best defense is a good offense, and as despite the fact that, as they said, allegations have certainly been made that Southern Air has been involved in the trafficking of drugs on behalf of the Contras, they decided they're going to sue Newsweek anyway. Southern Air Transport, of course, and the long history of CIA air proprietaries has been a repeated subject of interest to us here on One Step Beyond, and of course, it's going to continue to be right now, because if anything, it comes out of the Contras, the Nicaragua/Iran Gates scandal that is of value, that is of any lasting value. It's going to come out by the money trail being followed. And one of the places that the money trail threads is through all the different transport systems, which, of course, is why back in the late 40s and early 50s, the CIA started to put together things like their proprietary airlines in the first place, because you don't want to hire conventional airlines to do charter work for these kinds of nasty things. You want to hire people who are in debt to the agency, who the agency is either their direct employers or their frequent employers, and that's why they put these two operations together. And then the CIA in the 60s and 70s began to, quote, get out of the airline business. But again, strangely, people like Jim Dooley, George Dooley, thank you, the guy who founded most of the proprietary airlines, people like George Dooley kept cropping up on the boards of directors of these so-called, now civilian airlines, like Evergreen Airlines we were talking about. And it's rather interesting, too, in light of Southern Air Transport's seemingly huge involvement in this whole mess, that they have chosen, again, to go on the offensive and sue Newsweek for libel.
Now, again, we're wondering, perhaps in response to Iran scam Contragate, whether media news organizations, great and small, are being targeted perhaps to influence coverage in a fashion more favorable to the administration. At any rate, food for thought and grounds for further research. Remains to be seen what comes not only of the suit against Newsweek, but also of the charges, the allegations that Southern Air was, in fact, involved in drug trafficking. Remains to be seen whether those bear out or not. And then, of course, one of the complicating factors, too, is it may have been an airplane originally leased to them, may have been used, but that does not necessarily mean the organization per se has been. On the other hand, where you have the background of CIA air proprietaries such as Air America being involved in the opium traffic, according to Alfred McCoy, information which we looked at on one of our archive shows, it's the information worth thinking about. Now, one of the interesting connections of drugs and cocaine smuggling to Iran scam Contragate concerns the allegations that the Sandinistas were involved in cocaine smuggling, those coming from the late Barry Adler Seal. And Barry Adler Seal was involved with infiltrating, and at first were first working with and then infiltrating the Medellin cartel. Adler Barry Seal. Anyway, Mr. Seal, the late unfortunate Mr.
The late Mr. Seal. Right. That sums him up.
He was involved in first working with the so-called Medellin cartel of Colombian cocaine traffickers and then infiltrating same on behalf of DEA. He was also the fellow who arranged the sting whereby the Sandinistas were implicated in cocaine smuggling, and as it turned out, we looked at this at some length in previous broadcasts, and we will be doing, probably more than one archive show about Iran scam Contragate, perhaps in May. We'll do maybe a special in for the month of mayhem here on KFJC. At any rate, a key figure from the Medellin cartel was recently extradited to the United States, and there's been quite a brouhaha concerning his arrival in the United States and possible retaliatory measures to be taken by some of his cohorts in the Medellin cartel. Reading from the San Jose Mercury News of Friday morning, February 8, 1987, it's a Mercury News wire services story, Dateline Washington headlined, Agents on Alert After Extradition of Drug Kingpin. Federal drug agents and their families throughout the world were warned Thursday to be extra vigilant, unquote, to guard against possible retaliation resulting from the extradition to the United States of Colombian cocaine kingpin Carlos Leder Rivas, R-I-V-A-S, Leder, L-E-H-D-E-R. Officials throughout government praised the courage they said had been shown by Colombian President Virgilio Barco for moving against Leder, with Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Joseph Biden Jr., Democrat of Delaware, saying that Barco risked, quote, being shot dead, unquote. Leder, who was captured Wednesday after a gun battle between his bodyguards and Colombian soldiers at his remote ranch in northwestern Colombia, was ordered held under extreme security measures Thursday in Tampa, Florida, for a hearing Monday in Jacksonville. According to the Drug Enforcement Administration, Leder is associated with Pablo Escobar, E-S-C-O-B-A-R, Jorge Ochoa, O-C-H-O-A, and Fabio Ochoa in the Medellin Cartel, its name for the organization based in Medellin, Colombia, that reportedly is responsible for 80% of the cocaine smuggled into the United States. Skipping down on the article, law enforcement sources say that Leder stands out as one of the more bizarre and flamboyant characters in an underworld drug network known for its extreme behavior. They say that in the late 1970s, Leder purchased an entire island in the Bahamas where he based his drug trafficking activities. He built a 3,300-foot runway there protected by radar, armed traffickers, and Doberman attack dogs. While he lived in the Bahamas, investigators say, he owned a yacht and 19 cars and spent time with as many female friends at his private disco. Leder embraces a peculiar political philosophy, considering himself an admirer of Adolf Hitler as well as a supporter of some left-wing causes, sources said. The sources said that in 1982, Leder, a former member of the Colombian Senate, formed the political party Latino Nacional, which sought to abolish the anti-drug extradition treaty signed by Colombia and the United States. At a party convention, the backdrop to the podium on which Leder appeared was a huge photograph of Leder flanked by pictures of Hitler and Mussolini. In March of 1985, despite his status as a fugitive, he appeared in a television interview filmed from a jungle clearing in which he appealed to disgruntled army officers and members of Colombian Marxist revolutionary groups to participate in the, quote, cocaine bonanza, the arm of the struggle against America, unquote. He also characterized cocaine as the, quote, Achilles heel of American imperialism, unquote, before disappearing back into the jungle. And again, the information that came out that we looked at in connection with Barry Adler Seal is that all the people around him involved with this sting in which the Sandinistas were implicated in the drug traffic appear to have connections to the other side, namely the Contras. We looked at a number of articles from a number of sources. We're going to go back into those in an archive show. But around Badler, Barry Adler Seal, who was working with the Medellin cartel, was indeed cocaine trafficking, but it appears to have been linked to the Contras more likely than the Sandinistas. And so we'll go back into that information during our archive shows, and we'll have it on file at DAVCORP.